9. I am glad, I am happy to welcome Dr. Guy Aiken to today's seminar, and am eager to hear his presentation on the theme Kingdom Come, Martin Luther King Jr., Nonviolence and the Third Way. You all know Guy Aiken is a brilliant postdoctoral fellow and professor in this class. One just brief biographical word on our speaker today that you may find intriguing. While Guy wrote his doctoral dissertation on American Quaker humanitarianism in Germany and Appalachia between the world wars. This deep dive into Quaker activism created within Guy an ongoing interest in nonviolence and its, you know, its still untapped social energies. He would eventually design and create and teach a course on American nonviolence in the civil rights movement at Villanova University, where he was appointed as a postdoctoral student and fellow and a visiting professor in, I think it was the School of Humanities. Guy can correct me on this, where he served, as I said, as a visiting professor and faculty advisor. He recently published a monograph, an academic monograph that we should all put into our holiday reading list with the Dutch publisher Brill on the Quaker mystic Thomas Kelly, who is a remarkable human being. He's one of my and my wife's sort of theological intellectual heroes. In addition to publishing articles in the Tocqueville Review, Peace and Change and Diplomatic History, he is currently finishing a commentary on Thoreau's Civil Disobedience for a new social reading app called Threadable, which sounds really cool. In addition to earning a history degree, his PhD from UVA and an MA from the University of North Carolina, and history BA from Queens University in Charlotte, Guy attended Wake Forest University for theological and ministerial studies. What you may not know is that Guy is also an accomplished actor and singer. While studying at Wake Forest, I think, he produced the play The Last Days of Judas Iscariot, and he also taught the cast of 15 undergraduates about the play's context. We can also hear him perform in just a few weeks with the Virginia Oratorio Society in their annual holiday festival and concert. So yes, you all know Guy, and we are just grateful that you've joined us. You're back in Charlottesville, and that you're going to share with us today these important words on Martin Luther King's philosophy of nonviolence. So thank you.
Thank you. As Professor Morris said, I'm talking about King and the Third Way of Nonviolence. I'm calling the talk Kingdom Come, King and the Third Way of Nonviolence. Once I got to the end of it, I thought maybe I should have called it Kingdom Coming. but we'll talk about that once we get to the end. As Professor Marsh said, I do some acting. I do a lot of acting. And I love, that's sort of my first and greatest love, is to act. But I also have a deep love for Martin Luther King and nonviolence, the subject of nonviolence. And these both were sort of awoken in me at the same time. I was 10 years old. I was a fifth grader. This was early 1990. And we were celebrating Martin Luther King Jr. Day. So this would have been, I guess, late January 1990. And somebody, one of our teachers, showed a clip of King giving his I Have a Dream speech. And then after we watched it, she wanted somebody from our class. She wanted one of us little 10-year-olds, all of us white, to get up in front of the class and read the speech. I don't know exactly why. I don't remember why at this point. So one kid volunteered, went up there and did it. And we had just watched King's speech, and I was utterly captivated, totally swept away. I thought, this is, you know, where has this been my whole life? He at least gives the appearance of throwing his whole self into every single word that he says or writes. And this little kid who volunteered went up there, and he just kind of stumbled through it, read it sort of in a monotone. And I'm sitting in my seat, little 10-year-old me, and I'm getting really antsy because I'm thinking he's totally blowing us. He's totally blowing us. You know, he's not giving this what it needs, what it deserves, what we just heard and watched. And so once he got done, I raised my hand and said, can I try? And I got up in front of the class, and I was, as much as a little white 10-year-old could be, I was an African-American preacher. And I delivered the I Have a Dream, like the peroration at the end, you know, I Have a Dream and Let Freedom Ring and all that. And I was, you know, and I'm getting into it. I'm leaning into the other kids, and I'm just, you know, trying to get all the cadences that I just heard for the first time. And that was the moment when my love of King and my love of acting, I think, awoke at the same time, as well as maybe part of the insufferability of my ego might have awoken then at the same time as well. Because the poor little kid that I followed, I mean, I don't know how he felt. Yeah. So it's a great thrill and a pleasure to. And Ethan, do you need to? You want to grab your notebook or anything? Okay. So in brief, the purpose of my talk today is to present for you a comprehensive but not exhaustive picture of King's nonviolence, drawing out some of the various dialectics, as King called it, and some of the various partial yeses and partial noes that were always at work in King's mind, especially concerning the nature of the power of love, which we'll spend a good bit of time on. That King's dialecticism, his partial yes, partial no, this and that, both and, that way of thinking was of a piece with his conception of reality, with his basic philosophy. And his basic philosophy was personalism. Personalism was a philosophical school founded and fostered at Boston University, where King got his PhD and studied with the leading personalists of his day. Personalism holds that personality, the category of person, is the key to understanding all of reality. And by person, personalists, like King, mean essentially mind, will, desire, and intent, without which, they argue, no experience or intellection of any kind is possible to begin with. You can't do any investigation without these parts of person. So this is the concept of person, or as King often said, personality, that he has in mind, for instance, when he says in the letter from Birmingham Jail that any law that uplifts human personality is just. Any law that degrades human personality is unjust. So it's not the way that we use personality now. You know. It's a different way to use it. And persons, minds, wills, desires, and intents are essentially relational. They assume an object or subject toward which they move and with which they interact or communicate. So King, like all personalists, believed in the interrelated structure of all reality. And he says this a few times. He uses those very words a few times. The interrelated structure of all reality. And what that looks like for him in concrete historical terms is, as he says also in a letter from Birmingham Jail, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, because we are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. Another way of saying this is that no person can be a person without other persons. There is no person in isolation. There's only person in relation. There's only person in community. And this is why we need beloved community, which is not just tolerance and respect, but active, positive goodwill and desire to love the other person into their personhood. And when King discovered nonviolence in the lectures of some of his mentors about Gandhi, it hit him that he had stumbled upon a technique for social change that respected not just persons, but loved persons and preserved persons and fostered the community that persons need to be who they ought to be. So for King, nonviolence and personalism went together, were compatible. So let's move to his definition of nonviolence. And he sums it up for us very neatly and very articulately in Pilgrimage to Nonviolence. This comes from pages 78 to 79 on the bottom or on the side of the page, or pages 387 to 388 in the scan itself. And he says, nonviolence is not non-resistance to evil, right? It's not non-resistance to evil. That's what he thinks. that's the mistake he thinks Niebuhr makes. Niebuhr equates nonviolence with non-resistance to evil. I'm not sure he reads Niebuhr very charitably in that particular instance of Godowitz, but it sets up this definition. King says that nonviolence is a courageous confrontation of evil by the power of love in the faith that it is better to be the recipient of violence than the inflictor of it. Since the latter, inflicting violence, only multiplies the existence of violence and bitterness in the universe, while the former, just receiving violence, may develop a sense of shame in the opponent. And several of you have fastened onto this strategy or tactic of evoking shame in somebody and calling that into question. And we'll talk about that. So receiving violence may develop a sense of shame in the opponent and thereby bring about a transformation and change of heart. So let's dig just a little bit deeper into what King means by this, how he thinks nonviolence actually works. He sees it as a third way. Again, this dialectical thinking, partial yes, partial no. A third way between or a synthesis of perhaps flight and fight. He wants nothing to do with flight. He wants nothing to do with non-resistance. He wants nothing to do with submission. He says when he uses the word passive, which I wish he wouldn't do so much because I think it confuses people. He means passive physically, which also isn't necessarily true all the time either. But not passive morally, not passive spiritually, or however you want to say it. But the flight option does refrain from harming other persons. But in so doing, it destroys the self. It undermines one's sense of self. You lose respect for yourself. The other classic option, fighting, or violence, that's what King, you know, really means here, violence, fighting with violence. While that does assert yourself, it asserts your personhood, it affirms maybe your sense of somebodyness, as King would put it, but in so doing, it destroys community. So how do you preserve your sense of self while also preserving community, but not submitting to evil or injustice? Nonviolence. Nonviolent resistance is the third way. It restores or preserves your sense of dignity and self-respect and worth, while also preserving and maybe even strengthening community. And your personhood depends on other people, right? It depends on other person, so you need community. Well, what motivates this? What motivates you to resist nonviolently? Motivates or sustains you in a nonviolent campaign? Well, King thought that it was agape, love, which he distinguishes, as you've seen in several places, from eros, which is romantic love, the way we understand it, romantic love. And philia, which is friendship, love. Agape is a third, another third way here. Agape is a third way of expressing love. And in his understanding, analysis, and implementation of agape love, I think is where King really transcends Niebuhr, in particular. So agape love, let me caution you that what I'm about to say is partly my interpretation of what King is saying about agape love, but it is definitely founded on what King actually says about love. But this is my interpretation of what's going on. So agape love, the way King understands it, is an act of the will. Okay? It's a decision to work for the good of your opponent as well as for yourself. It is not, he says this, you've seen this, he says, it is not, agape love is not an emotion. It is not a feeling. You don't have to like your opponent to love them in the agape sense. But here's where I want to draw something out here for you. He talks about agape love often as understanding goodwill, or you know, asymmetric love. It's God's love in you pouring itself out without any expectation of anything in return. He does talk about it that way. But I think that's not the only way to understand agape love. Another way to understand agape love is that it serves you at the same time, not just at the same time as serving the other person. It serves you by serving the other person. And I think I can legitimately draw this conclusion from King's own personalism. The interrelated structure of all reality. I cannot be who I ought to be if you are not who you ought to be. What affects you directly affects me indirectly. We're caught up in a web of mutuality. All these ways that he talks about this. So when I do good to you, I'm not just doing good to you, I'm doing good to myself. Because we are inextricable. We are inseparable. My destiny is bound up with your destiny. My self-realization, my personhood is bound up with yours. So that's why even freeing, we're looking at, you know, nonviolent campaigns during the civil rights movement, even freeing a white person from their racial fear and hatred serves the black resistor. Because as the white person that you want to be in community with, need to be in community with, as long as their person is stunted or their personality is stunted, mine, or the black resistor's personality will be stunted. So two things about looking at agape love this way. I think one thing is that looking at it this way makes it accessible not just to people who are thoroughly religious. Possibly. That you might be able to enter this door of agape love even as a secular humanist, for instance. The second thing about looking at it this way, is that, like I said, I think it frees King from being mired in Niebuhr's pessimism concerning love in particular. So in Moral Man and Immoral Society, Niebuhr says love depends upon emotion. And that's why, and for Niebuhr in Moral Man, that's why love might decrease as one moves from individuals to groups. Because you can't sustain that emotion on a group because of various limitations in ourselves. But love is understood this way, as an act of the will, as serving yourself by serving the other, understanding that you are serving yourself by serving the other. That might actually be possible for groups and not just individuals. And a third thing about looking at agape love this way is that it at least starts to bridge what we often see is the divide, and we've seen it in the way, and Niebuhr sort of sets it up this way too, or the dichotomy between coercion and persuasion. Coercion and conversion. And this is where Livingston's article, I think, is especially helpful. Livingston says that King understood agape love as aggressive love. I wonder if any of us have ever thought of love as being aggressive. It's aggressive love. It's much more amenable to using coercion. As Livingston said, it might be loving to force your neighbor to be free. And this kind of love, Livingston says, motivates nonviolent resistance. This is a quote from Livingston. It's on page 858 if you want to find it later. Nonviolent resistance as an exercise of force seeking to create the conditions for persuasion. Coercing somebody to free them up psychologically so that now you're able to persuade them. Coercion in the service of persuasion, not coercion versus persuasion. So again, his quote from Merton, our Christian calling does not make us superior to other men. It does not entitle us to judge everyone and decide everything for everybody. We do not have the answers to every social problem. I mean, this is very Gandhian as well. Gandhi was all about humility, and all conflicts have not been decided beforehand in favor of our side. Our job is to struggle along with everybody else, collaborate with them in the difficult, frustrating task of seeking a solution to common problems which are entirely new and strange to us all. Merton studied and loved Gandhi as well. Yeah. Okay. Just two more parts left, right? So I'm going to go through. There are three ways in which King saw nonviolence as being superior to violence. I think much of which he had affirmed or learned or was inspired by what Niebuhr says about the superiority of nonviolence of moral man. So that's one part, the three superiorities of nonviolence. And then the last part will be nonviolence as the coming of the kingdom of God. My attempt at theological reflection. So there are three ways. This is very nuts and bolts. I understand that. Maybe you've been able to draw most of this out of the reads anyway, but I think it might be helpful just to get this in this form. So King thought nonviolence was morally superior, strategically superior, and tactically superior. Morally, strategically, and tactically superior. So he thought it was morally superior to submission. And I've already mentioned this. Because it endows the nonviolent resistor with dignity and self-respect. King was adamant that the first person that nonviolence changed was not your opponent, it was you. Nonviolence changed you. And he always wanted those on the front lines of nonviolent resistance to be those who are themselves subject to the injustice and the domination and the oppression that you're struggling against. Because they are the ones who need to assert their dignity and self-respect. Also, while submission to violence, you know, just giving up, curling up and letting somebody beat on you, you know, that might evoke pity in your opponent, but nonviolent resistance, King thought, would evoke shame rather than pity. And since, like I said, several of you have fastened on this, Ethan, you were talking about this during the break last week. Some of you brought it up in your posts that this sense that you can shame somebody into changing might be the shakiest pillar of King's philosophy of nonviolence. Because it's hard to see it actually happen. We see so much shamelessness. Catherine, in your post, you said, summary, that the dawn of beloved community is always preceded by a night of deeper shamelessness and injustice and self-righteousness. The white ministers, the eight white ministers in Birmingham who say, you know, King, your campaign is ill-timed. We need law and order. We don't need civil disobedience. So it might be a sort of increase in self-righteousness before we get to the beloved community, if we ever get there at all. Where I think shame does work, even much, much more often than in your face-to-face opponent, is a third-party observer. Somebody who's watching the news, for instance. Especially in the 1960s, when there are only a few TV news outlets, you know, I mean, three stations, I think, probably. And you saw in the Birmingham, the Albany and Birmingham documentary episode, that the lawyer from Birmingham says it was a masterpiece in using the media these aren't his words, but to essentially shame whoever's watching. So you might not be able to shame Bull Connor into changing, but somebody who's watching it, they might feel ashamed. And maybe it's easier for a third party to feel that shame because they're not the ones who are being exposed on national television. They have a little bit more space maybe to allow themselves to, you know, to have that sort of reaction of shame and guilt. Finally, nonviolence is morally superior to submission because it doesn't suppress or repress the rage that you feel, that you should feel, that injustice. It just channels it into avenues that preserve community rather than destroy it. All right, so the second way it's superior, it's strategic. Nonviolence is strategically superior to violence. In other words, and Niebuhr was big on this point as well, nonviolence is just, it's a more practical, politic way to try to change things. And for all the reasons that I've talked about so far, King thought that nonviolence would be better than violence. This isn't, you know, I mean, this is, makes a lot of sense. I mean, nonviolence would be better at attaining integration. You'd be able to integrate with the white community much more easily through nonviolence than through violence. And King thought that integration was a practical necessity. It was a practical necessity for African Americans because they were and are a minority in a democracy. And so they need allies. At that time they needed white allies and whites' active cooperation to form a majority voting bloc to get the legislation that they wanted to do. get the change that they wanted. It was just practically necessary. Integration was practically necessary, and nonviolence would make for a smoother transition to integration. So you get African Americans will be able to get what they want much faster, much quicker. And the other thing about nonviolence being practically superior, strategically superior, is that King, it's my sense that King wanted to work through the normal democratic procedures in a lot of ways, not just out of necessity, but because he thought that these democratic systems, institutions, and procedures were integral to actually forming a beloved community in this country, or maybe anywhere in the world. In other words, I think he did have a deep-seated belief in liberal democracy. He did not ignore the nightmare of white supremacy. Like some people then and now would want to accuse him of doing. But he thought the way out of that nightmare had to include the dream of liberal democracy. And these, and this sort of sentiment, I see it all through his public speeches. I should say that I don't know his sermons really at all, confession. But in his public speeches, all the way from his first big public speech in Montgomery at the founding, or the at the start of the Montgomery bus boycott, all the way to his last public speech in Memphis on April 3rd, 1968. He talks about the glory of America being the right to protest for right. One of his favorite phrases. The right to protest for right. He liked to say, I would understand if our right to assemble and our right to free speech were suppressed over there. By over there, he really meant, he probably meant Soviet Union, communist bloc. But here, we have the Constitution, and the Constitution guarantees us these rights, guarantees us the right to protest for right. And that is one of the glories of the United States. I think he was sincere about that. I think he meant that. Almost there. Third way is nonviolence is superior. It's tactically superior. It's tactically superior to just education by itself, to just persuasion by itself. Because nonviolent suffering in the face of violence hits the heart and not just the head. It can change, it has the potential to change the psychological conditions within which you are using your reason. So it can pierce through ignorance, willful ignorance. Has the potential to pierce through willful ignorance. And as Niebuhr also told us, nonviolence dramatizes evil without clouding the issue morally with violence. So it robs the opponent of the moral high ground. Okay, this is the last part of my remarks, and then we'll have some more time for question and answer if there are any. So this is my attempt to think theologically about King's nonviolence. And the way, and something about this just feels true in my bones. It might be wrong, but I hope it's wrong in such a way that makes you think. That's, you know, provocative in some way. So I wonder if the beloved community is not the same thing as the kingdom of God in King's thinking. But the beloved community is bound up with the kingdom of God in the same way that the community of early Christians in Acts, for instance, sort of emanated from, depended on the coming of the kingdom in Jesus Christ. In other words, I wonder that what God's kingdom looks like, what God's reign and rule looks like for us, just is nonviolence. And it's through nonviolence that we, or perhaps God, I think Professor Marsh is right to emphasize the theological side of things for King rather than the humanistic side, because King was not a secular optimist. He's not an optimistic humanist. Through nonviolence, God can establish the beloved community. And King's shift in rhetoric, at least in the sermons, from beloved community to kingdom of God, which Professor Marsh pointed out to us in his article from last week, it starts to happen around 1966 or so, and Marsh takes us from a scholar, Ronald Lisher, I think is his name, Ronald Lisher, who studied King's sermons. The shift in rhetoric from beloved community to kingdom of God is, I wonder if it's King's recognition that what he and other nonviolent leaders of the movement could accomplish was not the beloved community, but a living parable. Nonviolence is a living parable of God's love in search of justice and then the beloved community. The kingdom is always becoming, and what it looks like when it's coming is nonviolence. That's it. Yeah, thanks. Any questions, comments? We got some time before we, usually take our break. Yeah, Lil.
I have a brief question. This is just if I missed it. But just a second ago, you talked about things shift. I think you said from believing that what he could deliver was psychology.
Yeah.
Is that the sentiment of what you said? I just
Well, that's,
Do you believe in that?
That's my interpretation of what might be going on there. Yeah. Yeah, Professor Marsh.
Oh, hey, thanks. That was just really terrific.
Hold on. 1 second.
Yeah.
Hold on. Okay.
What was happening? Was somebody else bombing into the class?
The volume. It's hard to negotiate between the two things.
That was such a terrific lecture, and I know you'll have a generative and very compelling exchange after the break. If we go back to Montgomery. And King, during the year, King is sort of rolling out this, this moral, strategic, tactically savvy, theologically grounded, model of nonviolent resistance and nonviolent direct action. I guess it's a couple of hours east of Montgomery, on this sort of forlorn 400 acre plot of land in Southwest Georgia is a place called Quantanilla Farm that some students may remember from our visit there, our imaginative visit there through the writings of Clarence Jordan. And Jordan, working in the spirit of the Bruderhof and the historic peace churches, is creating resources of support for Montgomery. There are interesting kind of interactions between the two places. There were fundraising activities at the farm. Some of the members of the Quantanilla Farm drove over to, take part in the mass meetings. But Jordan, always found the King's, and the model of nonviolent direct action, interestingly enough, vulnerable to Niebuhr's criticism that the efficacy or the success of nonviolent direct action trades on the threat of violence. And in any case, Jordan added to that in his own defense of nonviolent non-resistance. The critique that nonviolent direct action inevitably seeks to humiliate or shame the other. And I finally read those two communities in a way that that mollifies those fairly sharp disagreements around the church and the social order. I would love to know how you would negotiate that debate between between the practitioners of nonviolent non-resistance and their critique of nonviolent direct action and these claims of the implicit violent intent of violence that accompanies nonviolent direct action. I'd just love to hear you put those two models together and say some things.
Yeah. One thing One thing to say is what King often said himself is that nonviolent direct action might uncover violence, but it doesn't create violence. It doesn't. What it does is it exposes the violence that's already present in the situation and brings it to light.
That's good. Yeah. I don't mean to interrupt you, but I'd just like to know your response to the quantity of Ruderhof historic Peace Church model of nonviolent non-resistance. I don't mean to generalize that across traditions, but at least as exemplified by the Quantineans.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my response is that nonviolent non-resistance is too unrealistic. I just think it is. I think it's too unrealistic. It often ends up being too sectarian to make any real impact on the majority of people's lives.
Nice.
I think it's a both and. I think what Koinonia Farm might be is a foretaste of the beloved community. But it's not a beloved community that's able to encompass anything much larger than itself. So how do you start bringing people, more and more people, into that fold of beloved community? I think it probably has to look something like nonviolent resistance.
And while, you know, it recognizes the inherent sinfulness of the human condition, it does betray a theological optimism about the social and, you know, political repercussions of witness, right? And I think that's part of what you mean by, which is a really interesting phrase, too sectarian to make an impact on people's lives. You know, the response might be, you know, we're not intending to make an impact.
Yeah.
We're intended to exemplify in this singular kind of social witness a new reality, a new kind of theological reality.
Yeah, for sure. So there's a biblical scholar named Walter Wink, whom you probably know about, Professor Walsh. And he wrote a trilogy of books on Jesus resisting the powers that be in the world. And he has this, in some ways, radical reinterpretation of the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus says, resist not evil, turn the other cheek, go the extra mile. If somebody asks for your shirt, give them your cloak too. He reinterprets each one of those admonitions as being counsels for nonviolent resistance, not non-resistance, but resistance. It's ingenious, totally ingenious. And maybe it doesn't convince every biblical scholar, but to me, it gets closer to the heart of what Jesus was doing than nonviolent non-resistance. I think Jesus was a nonviolent resistor, not a nonviolent non-resistor.
That's really helpful. That's a very helpful answer. And if there's any way you could give us direction to some of those passages in week, we'd all be grateful. Thank you so much. That was a great answer.
Yeah. Any other questions? Comments?
It's time for coffee.
Time for coffee. Yeah, and some water. Okay, yeah, thank you all very much. Thank you, Professor Marsh. Thanks.
Thank you. That was terrific.